the distribution of the film. I referred to that earlier. The channel of transmission is a little bit more interesting, and I think people are beginning to get at a sophisticated analysis of how the transmission is constructed. It seemed to me when I watched the silent screen that it was an image of an image of an image. It's three concentric frames, in fact, because, and especially if you watched it on ABC Television News, you're watching your television. There's your television screen, within which you have the monitor, right, of the video display, within which you have the image of the sonogram, right? And each of these frames connotes a different message, a different content, in fact. Our own TV or video screen, which frames a male narrator and a sequence of events, connotes the most familiar form of truth picturing in our culture, the news. We're watching the news, we're watching events, these things are happening. However skeptical we are, there's some sense of that when we watch this film. The second screen, the video display, registers the sonogram image, connotes fetology, right? Advanced, we're on the frontier now of obstetrical medicine. The latest thing it can do, it can show us every, and he, of course, accentuates this by saying how finely deep-brained, he claims the image can be. And finally, the image of the fetal form, amorphous, dense as an ink blot, as somebody was saying, it's really, you were pointing out, it's really actually very fuzzy. And yet, when we look at it, we feel in through all of that fetal imagery that we've been exposed to in the larger culture anyway. We're aware at one and the same time that it's a dull, it's an amorphous image, and at the same time it connotes a lot of things for us. The most interesting though of these three moments or points is the point of reception. How we are constructed ourselves to see this film. As feminists, we are angered by it, right? We're annoyed by it. We're picking up on a lot of contradictions in it, the hokiness of the music. At the very moment, everybody laughed, when the organ music comes on at just a particular moment. And yet it seems to me that we have to be open to our own vulnerability to this proliferation of images, everything from billboards, 2001 A Space Odyssey, and so on. All of these images rescue the film from utter absurdity. They give it a context, they make it credible within the larger culture, because the fetal form has had an imprint in the larger culture, a symbolic import that condenses within it a whole series of losses: sexual innocence, compliant women, American imperial might. It is the homunculus, this fetal form. And what we have to do, I think, and what actually disturbs me a lot, is that I hear very few feminists actually critiquing the straight image, as opposed to the garbage can images. The fetal form itself, which is a dismembered, disembodied image, and utterly a fetish. I just like to say the fetus is a fetish. Fetal images now permeate the American cultural landscape, and I believe saturate abortion discourse. I'm probably contributing to that by giving this talk and writing this paper. The curled up profile with its enlarged head and fin-like arms suspended the most benign of these fetal images is the most familiar. It's in its amniotic sac, and it's very familiar to us. It's sort of swinging out there in space. And this prototypical fetal image epitomizes the very distortion that is inherent in all photographic images. Their tendency to slice up reality, to disembody, to compartmentalize, and wrench out of historical context and social context. When Nathanson claims to be presenting an abortion from the vantage point of the victim, of course, we have to immediately challenge that. If the fetus had any vantage point, it could not possibly experience itself as dangling in space without a woman's uterus and body and bloodstream to support it. So in this respect, every one of those fetal images is a fetish, an artificial construct, representing the standpoint of neither an actual fetus nor a pregnant woman, but a male onlooker. Barbara Katz Rothman, in her new book, writes about this. She has a wonderful thing I love to quote. She says, "The fetus in utero has become a metaphor for man in space, floating free, attached only by the umbilical cord to the spaceship, while the pregnant woman has become empty space." That was the end of the quote. This is my part. Inside this futurizing spacesuit, however, is a much older image. The free-floating fetus extends to gestation the Hobbesian view of born human beings as disconnected, solitary individuals who are paradoxically helpless and also autonomous at the same time. They're both helpless and vulnerable and autonomous and heroic and male. This abstract individualism effaces the pregnant woman and the fetus's dependence on her. The story, just wipes them outside. And that it also gives the fetal image its symbolic transparency, its usefulness as a symbol, so that we can read in it a whole lot of things. Ourselves, our lost babies, our mythic past. Medical technology, of course, enhances, and all the emphasis on fetology, the focus on the fetus through ultrasound imaging, prenatal diagnosis, in vitro fertilization, electronic fetal monitoring, all of these kinds of things, fetal therapies, focusing on the fetus as patient, the visualization of the fetus in utero earlier and earlier in the pregnancy. It kicks, it spits, it grows, it excretes. These seem to verify its separateness, its autonomy, and to contribute to this fetocentric culture in both obstetrics and, I think, in the larger society. It seems to me that the increasing emphasis on the problem of viability plays into this a great deal, and what we find, I think, picked up in the culture is Sandra Day O'Connor's image of, we're pushing viability back further and further and further indefinitely so that we're going to save tinier and tinier fetuses. And I was struck when extent to which this was picked up in television last year. One program that I saw was Hill Street Blues. Did anybody see Hill Street Blues? When it was a story about, was ostensibly a story about clinic violence. There was a confrontation in front of the clinic, and a very sort of feeble anti-abortionist reaches out with his picket sign, and he whacks this woman who's 5 months pregnant, who's standing around in front of the abortion clinic, sort of figuring out, is she going to get an abortion or not? And she miscarries and is in the hospital, and in fact, it ends up that this live baby is born, and there's a tableau. And in fact, the whole focus of the program, ostensibly about clinic violence, is actually in this hospital room where you see this holy family scene of the woman is married. She's atypical as an abortion, quite totally atypical. She's married, she has 3 kids, she's like in her early 30s or something. And here she is with her husband who's out of work, and they're weeping. And this little fetus is on the side in a little incubator, and then it dies, and they are holding each other and weeping. And in other words, it's really about a baby and a family, even though this show was supposed to be about abortion. And in this kind of imagery, abortions are really babies. Abortions are really more and more late abortions, which is not the truth. Something like 92% of all abortions are in the first trimester, and a very large proportion of them in the first 8 weeks in the society, and that's not changing, that's not growing, it's in fact remaining somewhat stable. So these images blur the boundary between fetus and baby. They reinforce the idea of the fetus's identity as separate and autonomous from the mother, or the living separate child, as Nathanson calls it. I don't know, this might be completely silly, but I wonder, don't have any empirical evidence, whether people's reactions to these fetal images are gender specific. Whether women may be inclined to see those images through the veil of their own pregnancy losses and longings. Men, on the other hand, lacking any experience or anticipation of pregnancy, may relate to fetal forms as replicas of the self, heroically surviving as if by its own powers, or alternatively, mortally threatened by maternal power. I just offer that to you. And it ties into the Hobbesian thing. What?
Okay, the two types of penetration in the movie. They look, somebody who they hear this line of the penetration of the abortionist, whereas of course what the movie is also trying to show is the penetration onto the fetus.
Right.
And that can talk columns in real passionately. The subtext there often is save me. Save me.
Yes, I am hopeless, I am vulnerable. But at the same time, I am heroic. And I am autonomous. I do not need you. I'm a survivor. Both things at one and the same time. Now, if these images are being inscribed in the culture, in television, science fiction, film, fantasy, and so on, one wonders to what extent they have penetrated the clinical viewings of ultrasound images. I don't know. This is, I'm just playing with this.
Specific. Are you implying that the showing of this film will polarize the genders?
No. I'm just implying that how one responds might be different depending on whether. I will also argue, though, that how one responds as a woman is going to be dependent on a lot of things that the film doesn't, take it into account. I don't think feminists who have critiqued reproductive technology have either taken it into account. It will be dependent on that woman's class and race, her situation in society. It will also be dependent on her biological situation. I hesitated to say it. Her pregnancy history. I mean, the evidence we have is that how women respond to things, and some good studies have been done, electronic fetal monitors, whether they experience electronic fetal monitors as invasive or helpful is correlated to a large degree with what their pregnancy history has been. Have they had a history of miscarriages, fetal losses, difficulties, they welcome that technology. Now, this isn't universally true, but it tends to be a pattern. Have they not had that kind of history, they see it as invasive, intrusive, they don't want it around. And I think that's interesting and worth our thinking about, since we tend to discount individual biology and to ignore that, in fact, biology too is historical and it's particular. Its particularity is what makes it important for us to take into account. That's sort of jumping ahead. I think there are just a couple of points I want to make about the second question that I raised, which is how do real women respond to these kinds of images given the cultural strong cultural definition of the images. One is that I think women's responses are in some ways going to be mediated by male clinicians' responses. I mean, I think that's to some degree unavoidable. We still have a patriarchal medical establishment. Most obstetrician gynecologists are men, and I'm not encouraged by how they describe the language they use to talk about the experience of ultrasonography, what it is they're doing and what it is they are seeing. I'm reminded of some of the writing of Evelyn Fox Keller about science and its gender bias, and also about the prevalence of the gaze in medical science. And I just thought I'd read you a couple of quotes. Of course, these are very selective, but they seem to reinforce Keller's analysis of male-dominated science as a battlefield and also as a voyeuristic enterprise. I'll skip my quote from Life magazine, when it first presented a sonar look at the unborn baby in January 1965. Described it this way. This was the first description I could find of ultrasonography in popular media. The astonishing medical machine resting on this pregnant woman's abdomen in a Philadelphia hospital is looking at her unborn child in precisely the same way a Navy surface ship homes in on enemy submarines. Using the sonar principle, it is bombarding her with a beam of ultra-high frequency sound waves that are inaudible to the human ear. Back come the echoes, et cetera, et cetera. Then here's Nathanson, interviewed in Newsweek just after The Silent Scream was released. He boasted, "With the aid of technology, we stripped away the walls of the abdomen and uterus and looked into the womb." And here was was Michael Harrison, writing in a respected, actually, medical journal about fetal management through ultrasound imaging. The fetus could not be taken seriously as long as he remained a medical recluse in an opaque womb. And it was not until the last half of the century that the prying eye of the ultrasonogram rendered the once opaque womb transparent, stripping the veil of mystery, I'm saying like, stripping the veil of mystery from the dark inner sanctum and letting the light of scientific observation fall on the shy and secretive fetus. The sonographic voyeur spying on the unwary fetus finds him or her a surprisingly active little creature and not at all the passive parasite we had imagined. Now, whatever your thoughts about, and I do, I, you know, one can go on about this in terms of feminist critiques of objectivity and the pretense of objectivity. Nevertheless, and I don't think voyeurism is something specifically male, but it still strikes me that the sighting of the womb as a space to be conquered can only be had by one who stands outside it looking in. This view of the fetus as a little shy gazelle. It's also this predatory notion of ultrasonic. You can strip it away and we can seize the image.
It's like women's bodies just in the way.
Yes. It's the panoptics of the womb, really, and that's very much present.
I have heard older doctors who speak with nostalgia for the lost auditory and tactile techniques. You know, the auscultation of the chest, for example, which is totally now replaced with x-ray and CAT scan, all kinds of things in there. There is a, you know, a feeling that there's increased distance, and that this represents a loss.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, there is increased distance, but apparently some clinicians find that, you know, in ways liberating, and others, certainly increased distance for the woman as a patient, and what feminist writers like Barbara Tess-Rothman and Ruth Hubbard and people point out dramatically is the displacement of the woman as patient, you know, her sort of peripheral positioning now, turned away, the doctor turned away from her, examining her baby, which is, you know, out here on the screen. I have a cartoon of it, actually, that I can pass around. At the same time, and I think that's true, and I think that, we don't have very much time, I just want to point out this argument that I would make. Even though it's true that the uses of ultrasound seem to be in the direction of displacing women, objectifying them more in clinical contexts, at the same time, women themselves do not always experience ultrasound imaging as alienating or objectifying to them. What they express sometimes is that they sense a direct participation and even elation in seeing these images, that it makes the baby more real, it makes it our baby, that visualizing the fetus creates a feeling of intimacy. Having that little photograph, you said that, I guess it didn't impress you too much, Barbara, but taking home that sonogram photograph, which is not very common, you get a still photograph of your ultrasound image to take home and put in the baby album. That this,
my friend Eddie showed that to the little boy.
Yeah.
And he's very, very interested in the image, in fact.
So, I just to interrupt, I mean, I was struck that they gave you this picture. Right. And the reason I think I wasn't impressed was just maybe because I didn't want to look at the fetus as a baby. And I haven't showed it to my kids yet. I want to know after this session I can think about how I'd present it to them.
Well, I think we need to think about why the experience may be one of self-empowerment in certain circumstances, and in what circumstances that may be true, that women may be having a sense of greater control over pregnancy. And particularly, of course, this is going to be when one wants to have a pregnancy and a baby. Obviously, when one does not, it's very, very different. But it seemed to me, just to make one or two points about this, that some of the reasons why women may be experiencing these images as empowering, even though others may be finding it intimidating, those who want to get abortions. And I don't know, I've just heard a few stories that in fact young women viewing the silent screen decide not to get abortions. We don't have any great hard evidence about that at this point. One thing that is the point that I made before about pregnancy laws, that it would appear, and this was true of Kristen Luker's women, your right to life women, who saw the fetus and fetal images as their little guy, who identified with it very strongly. Many of them, a disproportionate number of them, had a history of pregnancy or child losses. Second, if we look at the women who comprise the market for high-tech obstetrics, including ultrasound, they are mainly the ones who can afford these procedures at this point in time. They are mainly middle-class, upscale women who are products of a middle-class culture that values planning, control, predictability in the interest of a quality baby, who are being told more than ever that that to produce a non-quality baby is irresponsible. That they have the tools, they have the apparatus now, so they had better use it and come up with the best quality product that they can select, and they can, and they are responsible for quality control for how the baby turns out. A third, and of course that's very double-edged for women. That's a reinforcement of women's traditional guilt. Some women, in fact, experience, however, the ability to produce a quality baby, of course meaning a non-disabled baby, and there's a strong undercurrent here of a bias against disability, as a kind of power that they have control over something they wouldn't have had control over 20 years ago. And that obviously raises hard questions, I think, for feminists who inherit an ideal, a value of liberal choice. The value, to the extent that we place value on the idea of that woman's right to decide, that woman's right to control her pregnancies, etc., we have a real problem then making value judgments about her decision, which we don't like. Her decision to, after amniocentesis, abort, you know, the wrong sex fetus, or to have an abortion based on some perception of disability, for those of us who are very concerned about disability rights. So that's a very problematic area. A third point I'll make about the predisposition of women is to situate the whole discussion back in the realm of photography. It seemed to me, hearing about, never having experienced this, getting your little picture, your fetal sonogram picture to take home and put in the baby album, that it located ultrasound imaging in a tradition, a very familial tradition of family photographs, right. Particularly among middle class people. Family albums originated to chronicle the continuity of bourgeois kin groups. Home movies in the 1940s and 50s, going back to the barbecue. Who made the home movies? Mommy. Mommy made the home movies. Mommy kept the baby album. And it's mommy who takes home the ultrasound picture, in some cases, in one case, documented anyway, to a dying grandfather to affirm that the lineage was coming along, even though he was going to die before it was born. It's the woman who keeps up the album, takes the films, and the specific relationship of women to photographic images helps explain the attraction, I think, of pregnant women to ultrasound images of their own fetus. One more point about this, and it gets back to the thing you were talking about, Anne. Both objective, it is both outside and you are bonding with it. It seems to me that rather being surprised that some women experience bonding with their fetus after viewing its image on a screen, perhaps we should understand this as a culturally embedded component of desire. If it is a form of objectifying the fetus, and also the pregnant woman is detached from the fetus, perhaps such objectification and detachment are necessary for her to feel erotic pleasure in it. If the ultrasound image, she recognizes the fetus as real, it's out there, perhaps this means she can first experience it as an object she can possess and, in some ways, have a sense of her own empowerment. I'm just, again, speculating. But I think it's much more complicated the business of imagery, that it clearly raises for us a lot of questions about what's going on with technology. And finally, while I think that we have two problems, I'll just conclude on this thing. I think we have two problems, at least. One of them is that we have to confront public images of the public fetus by, in some ways, recasting the imagery, reinserting the fetus back in the pregnant woman back in society, back in her whole set of social circumstances, and that's part of the problem of re-embedding abortion back in all the range of reproductive health, sexual, and social problems. That's one task. And so it's a task of really confronting and changing the imagery from a fetocentric culture to back to a woman-centered set of images. The other task we have, though, it's very different. We have to look at situations where women are making decisions based on fetal technology, decisions sometimes that we might not like. And we have to think through how do feminists approach moral questions. I think we have to do that in a very, very serious way and decide whether we are happy with the idea of individual choice as the only basis for making decisions. I don't know if that got us too far from the silent screen, but anyway. Does anybody have any further comments? Yeah, Vaughn.
I'm struck and pleased with thinking about the notion of the blanketing of cultural images that sort of recall feminism, reflect the feudal form, and being someone who's often treated as being crazy about abortion and seeing it everywhere, I feel reaffirmed by this point. But then there is a complicated question, it seems to me, that even before we give image to feminism, women identify images are fetal in character. I mean, I was just saying this a few before. There's something about the whole thing about cats today, and like all of those with cars and
kittens on posters and calendars.
Yeah, and particularly the rolled up cats, and sort of, you know, and I sort of think about T.S. Eliot and the smock. And there is something, you know, if we think about what are male images and what are female images in society, there's something resonant about those things which one can see as fetal images, with images that have been traditionally sort of comforting and seen as sort of women connected or women love. And I think there's something very complicated about drawing on something, and there's no way that's going to say that they are women images, but drawing on something that goes way back before the ability to visualize the fetus in associating in trying to recreate an association between the good woman and the nurturing woman. And then feminism, in its dichotomization of women images and men images and women images, sort of, you know, we're not a part of the sort of recreation of that context.
We're not actively redefining what images of nurturance are, and we risk, I mean, the whole idea of re-embodying the fetus means emphasizing woman as nurturer, woman as vessel for, you know, and what do we have as an alternative? Castrated. He said that. Yeah. you know, scariness. Yeah.
Now, when you were talking about the change of image, I thought I might have to be sure that the change in the sexual attention of this miscarriage is seen as occurring earlier in the country. And the menstrual cycle, there are studies going on now, studies going on now to detect undetectable. So that people who are planning to be pregnant can solve them to see if they miscarry before they know they're pregnant. And in addition to that, to noticing that miscarriage is a terrible and more than making it into social reality, there's also the attention to mourning and grieving the lost child and and that's never been an issue.
It's being brought into existence earlier and earlier, and therefore we should mourn it earlier, even where in the past we wouldn't have mourned it because we didn't know it existed. Yeah.
Well, we have to know it existed because it started in 1919 and these images and all those in this gallery are pictures of pictures. I struggle with the fact that there are other than pictures of the sexual attachment to those who are new and partly because there was airbrushed out a lot of times. Which was things that are good. You do not get a previous thing and only understand what they have in the public in the 65 or 66, that it is not the result of some kind of science not making sense.
So it's so with so the image is
back to we're starting to move it to, you know, to define these characters to the earlier times has to do with the fact that we have images we're seeing. Photographs of miscarriages, but that we are never consciously told by a photograph that it's a miscarriage. That somehow this sweet, peaceful piece of scene, we never read why it is that you have this picture.
This is so shaped with a sense of a new iconography that you've been drawing. I just find it so suggestive and rich. And it just it takes me in different directions. One is this question that Ian also asked fleetingly, which is that as we see the politics that comes from these shifts, and I mean that are partly the cause of them and partly the result of them, how it will start to change how many women talk about pregnancy and what kinds of gender-specific languages may arise. Not only the thing that you said about perhaps the fetus as the male self, and which is so clear when those doctors try to peer in past the woman into this other self of the cells, but just more generally, the sense that maybe men will feel differently about pregnancy, closer to it as well as for the woman. I mean, the woman, of course, has that moment of bonding and intimacy, but there may be that sense that if you can think of the fetus as separate from that woman who's made from the fetus, there are a whole bunch of new psychological issues in relation to pregnancy might arise, and different gender-specific problems. And I don't necessarily, I'm just thinking out loud, think that all of those would be negative. I mean, maybe there's some very interesting some bonding, male bonding with the fetus that never could happen before, that one could conceive of in a feminist frame. You know, if one were building one's own icons here, one would talk about the both parents being able to look at the same picture and the father having much more stake in a sense of the physicality. Though I think that's hard, and I'm not sure about that. But maybe it doesn't happen that way, but just the idea that we're at a moment when all of that is shifting around, and it's just absolutely, in a way, it's up for grabs.
Well, I would respond to that, but Carol's hiring up, so
you know. Embedded in the story of in vitro fertilization is a man's discussion of what a remarkable thing it is to see his child before the baby they conceive as the artist. And his wife, of course, is only able to see these eggs because she's unconscious on the operating table. We're having to go out of the apartment outside while we do the procedure. But it did create a sense of bonding.
See, there's that. Men have bonded with their, in a sense, in a certain patriarchal sense, men have bonded with their unborn children for, you know, eons as objects of proprietary interest.
Well, they were the homunculus again. They just put them there. Yes, oh, certainly. Right. And that's the more scary part. I think that's the thing we think of first. I'm just trying to think whether we can't, you know, it seems to me that part of what you've done that's so exciting is this sense of it all, you know, sort of almost unfolding, almost like a fast photograph of the shifts in how we're seeing this, almost year to year, the different ways we're going to be able to see it 3 years from now, 5 years from now. I mean, it's very kinetic material.
Artificial womb experiment, and there was a doctor who was the husband, and the wife was supposed to pretend by wearing pillows that she was pregnant, and she would pull the plug anytime. She had a friend who was saying it was bad for her, and she would go pull the plug, blah, blah, blah. She finally went down and said, I want to pull the plug, and it's like, and they realized they had to wear her suit. Right? And so she was taken into the laboratory where this fetus was floating and feeble. The man who's engaged day to day in the nurture of this fetus, who had the daily contact, and she was out there told me a lot, not knowing what's happening, the baby was going to go somewhere else, said, see, dear, it's my baby, and she said, oh, this is the baby.
This is CBS. True.
This was a CBS. I don't think I dreamt it.
And this will not revolutionize, and what determines the meanings of ultrasound images will still be the social relations of childbearing and how we try to change them.
So that was my point. The feminist brain, one can even dream of using it in this way,
yes.
That we don't
have.
Could
use it. We could use it.
We could use it. That is the point. You're not simply saying this is an intrusion.
No.
Okay.
No, I'm not saying that.
No.
Something seems prostitute women, and some of Barbara has happened, and stuff. And that's part of why I tried to write this, because I feel it's a much more ambiguous situation. That doesn't mean it's too soon for ideologically the idea that this is separate, this is potentially separable from you, therefore you should have no say over whether it lives or not. Right? But that's morally now.
Precisely, and those who are not treated with connection to that kind of role as well.
this is the last one, then we're going to break. Oh, there's a real question. I raised that in this paper and didn't discuss it here. But there is some question as to not only safety, but efficacy. In other words, what really is accomplished by routine ultrasound imaging? There was a major report of a group of physicians that questioned, in fact, the routine use of ultrasound imaging. There's no conclusive evidence that it's safe. There's no conclusive evidence that it's harmful. But there's also no conclusive evidence that it's safe, especially in terms of things like embryos. No long-term studies.
And also, they're using them very frequently. I can't remember where the source was, but there are some of them who are getting them every few weeks because of some small problems, recent problems. So they're having 10, 12.
It's very interesting. I mean, why do doctors want to use this? It goes back to this thing about the prevalence of the gaze and the compulsion almost to see. The assumption that if you can just see, you'll figure out some problems that are there. So if you look at the indications listed in obstetrics textbooks and manuals on ultrasound imaging, the indications are rump to head measurement. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll get a hundred minutes.